we are with our driveways, but you can't go from snow to dry ground without mud, so let's get through it and get over it. Thought I should maybe with the day of spring display my level of poetry. It goes something like, spring is sprung, the grass is riz, I wonder where them flowers is, but that's all I know about poetry. That's the extent of it. So anyway, let's begin with the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 10. It's good to have this. Last week we ended up in the end of chapter 9, and we talked about the proverbs that Solomon has introduced now as just ways of things that we should do that would make our life a little bit better here on this earth. Again, it's the natural man. How can we make things a little bit more tolerable for this empty and vain life? So he introduces some proverbs here. The end of verse 18, we read, "But one sinner destroyeth much good." And we looked at the life of Achan and the damage that was done as he brought sin into the camp and the defeat that came to the nation as a result of that. Now we want to go on now in chapter 10 to some others of these proverbs that he gives. And this is one that deals with, in verses 1 through 3, with the importance of establishing and maintaining a good reputation. As I said, again, this is the book of man. And I think what he is referring to is our reputation in the world, in our business life, in our home life, the way that people think of us. But I think we should look at this more from the idea of what is our testimony for the Lord. Yes, we need a good reputation, that's fine, but we really build reputation based upon us. And I think what we need to emphasize in this study today is our testimony for the Lord and the damage that we can do to that with inappropriate and unwise actions. Beginning in chapter 10, verse 1, we read, "Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, that his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to every one that he is a fool." Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that you would be with us as we study your word today. We just thank you for this passage. I pray that we would understand and glean the things from it that you would have for us. We pray too for our pastor and the other Sunday school teachers today and for the message that follows the Sunday school hour. Pray that you would speak to each of our hearts, that there would be nothing that would keep us from hearing and receiving what you have for us. I pray in Christ's name. Amen. This is probably one of a common saying we hear. That's the fly in the ointment. I'm guessing you hear it quite frequently. I'm guessing most people that use the phrase have no idea where it came from, and probably more importantly, don't understand the context and what it's referring to. I know I was listening to WNEX some time back, and a few weeks or months, I'm not sure, time gets away, but the market reporter on there and the lady that hosts that, and she was talking to a market analyst, and they were talking about all the things that should be positive for the market, all the things that should be causing it to go up, but it wasn't. And she said, well, that one thing that was causing it, that's the fly in the ointment. And we hear that phrase. It just means that something bad, something that you shouldn't have, it's fly in the ointment. It's like fly in your soup or something like that. You just don't want it. But if we look at this and look at the context of it, it has a much deeper meaning than that. Now, the ointment of, it starts out, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. The ointment of the apothecary, that's a very precious ointment. It's a tremendously valuable, a tremendously precious commodity in the ancient world. And we know that even in the New Testament, we, in three of the Gospels, record the story of Mary of Bethany and the ointment that she used, that she anointed Jesus Christ. And the criticism that she received because it was so valuable and it was so expensive. Why was it wasted, quote unquote, like this? The account that we think of most often is the one from the book of John, in which it is Judas that is the center of that passage, and saying, well, why waste this ointment? It's so valuable. Why couldn't this valuable oil be sold and the money given to the poor? And it goes on to explain, not that he cared about the poor, but he was the thief. He had held the funds of the disciples, and he was, it said the funds were in the bag, and he pilfered a little now and then when he wanted it. Said he was a thief. He didn't care about the poor. But if you look at the other passages in both Matthew and Mark, it isn't just Judas, but it says all of the disciples were disgruntled about this. All of the disciples were commenting of what a waste this was and how all this ointment was being wasted. But it was a very precious and a very valuable commodity. And that was the point I wanted to make from there. But it says here that dead flies cause that ointment to stink, causes it to be ruined. If in the making of this, the ingredients are put in, if the vat of ointment isn't protected and flies kept from getting in, they get in, they're probably attracted by the smell of the various ingredients that go in. They get into this vat of ointment, the flies die there, their bodies deteriorate, and what happens? This vat of ointment starts to stink. It's ruined. Something that should have been very valuable, something that was a very precious commodity, ends up being worthless. It ends up just, what do you do with it? You just throw it out. It's no good for anything. And so all of the ingredients, all of the time, all of the money that went in making that is gone. It's worth nothing. And we look at that and we hear, well, that's the fly in the ointment. Well, that's as though that's the end of the story. But the context here is much greater than that. It goes on the rest of that verse, so doth a little folly him that is a reputation for wisdom and honor. What it's saying is that a little misdeed, a little indiscretion, some foolish act that we do is the same thing as dead flies in the ointment. It ruins our testimony. It ruins our reputation. It says it ruins our... The same thing happens to him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. It's just like putting flies in the ointment. Our reputation can begin to stink. Is that what we want? Whether we're just talking about a worldly context of our reputation and our standing in the community, or whether really talking about what's important, our testimony for the Lord, we should be so careful to keep those flies out. Keep our testimony from being ruined, our testimony for the Lord. It should be much more valuable to us than the most precious of perfumes or ointments or anything that the world can make. And yet it says that those dead flies that cause that ointment to stink are just compared to indiscretions and folly that we may commit and things that we may do. You know, we can work a whole lifetime to gain a stellar reputation. Sometimes we do that out of pride. We have to recognize that. But we should be very careful about our reputation and the way that we live. One mention or one listing in the docket in the paper for DUI, what does that do to our reputation? One crime. Being sentenced for drug possession or drug distribution. It only takes one. How many off-color jokes do you suppose you have to tell at the break room before that dead fly spoils your reputation? Is it one a week you can get away with? Is it one a month, one a year? Or is it just one? It doesn't take long for that gossip to get around the whole plant. That's what we really stand for, especially if we've been a vocal and a witness as we ought to be and verbal about our love for the Lord, and then we act like that. What are we doing putting those dead flies in our life? And we should be maybe a little bit more aggressive with some fly spray to keep those things out, so to speak, to keep them out of our life. You know, one improper activity one indiscretion, one time cheating with our spouse, one thing like that, one shady business deal that we pull in the community. What kind of a testimony is that? You know, we should be so careful to keep those dead flies out. And that's what that type of activity is. It's just dead flies. And it destroys our reputation. It destroys our testimony for the Lord. Goes on in verses 2 and 3 that kind of explain this in a little greater detail. They're all connected to this same verse. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. Now, I could make a political joke out of that, but I probably shouldn't. But anyway, in the ancient world, the right hand was a picture or a euphemism for the place of blessing, the place of goodness, the place of honor. And I think of that, where was Christ seated in heaven? At the right hand of God, the place of honor. That's on the right. The left was pictured in the ancient world, in the ancient time, as the place of curse, the place of evil, the place of bad things. And so we see that it says the fool's heart goes in that direction. And so the wise man's heart, we're directed to that place of goodness. The wise man's heart will be directed to the place of decency and blessing. The fool's heart is going to be directed to the place of curse, the place of a curse, and the place of evil and bad things. And it's just like those dead flies in our life. Verse 3, yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. You know, when we are out and about in the community, the way we live our lives, we might, sometimes the things we do, we might as well have moron stamped on our forehead. Because it says that it broadcasts to the world what we really are. And people know that he saith to everyone that he's a fool. Now, I've heard the story told that, you know, it's better off to keep your mouth shut, have everybody think you're a fool, than to speak up loudly and remove all doubt. And, you know, that's so easy to do. The world can see what we're doing. The world knows when we're acting like a fool. And especially if we've made an effort to have a good testimony in the community, if we've made an effort to have a good reputation, if we've made an effort as we ought to have a verbal witness, what does it do when we have those dead flies in our life? It not only says we're a fool, but it makes a mockery of the gospel. And we need to be so careful of that. So careful. Even the people that don't like our beliefs and don't like our standards and don't like our stand, you know, they can still have a point of respect if you're a person of integrity and a person of decency. Get rid of those dead flies. We probably need a real dose of flypaper or a dose of fly spray to keep the flies out. Because just like dead flies make the ointment to stink, these indiscretions and the way that we sometimes act, it makes our testimony stink. I don't know of any way to soften that. I don't know of any way to come across as polite or comforting, but that's what our actions can do, can make our testimony for the Lord to stink. Moving on here, I've kind of beat that into the ground, but I think that's so important that we remember what kind of a life we live and the testimony we have. Going on to verse 4, he goes to another proverb. It carries on through a number of these verses. But he says in verse 4, if the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. Again, this is back to the ruler. This is really speaking of the intolerant, the sovereign king, the type of ruler that's can do whatever he wants to. And it says that if he gets mad at you and rises up against you, you need to be very careful how you confront him, how you deal with that king. It's not saying we should never do that. On Book of Acts, we must obey God rather than man. And there are times we need to stand up against the king. We need to stand up, but be careful how we do that. remember, there may be a cost to pay. We should count that cost before we do that. I'm not saying we never should stand up for injustice or things that are wrong and things that are done. Fortunately, we live in a country that if we, every 2, 4, 6 years, depending on the term of office, we have every opportunity to throw the bums out, as the saying goes. And we can do that without threat, without penalty, but we also need to know that sometimes in the bureaucracy, they have unlimited resources to come after you, and even if you're right, you can go broke trying to fight it. But we need to count the cost. And it's saying here that if he rises up, sometimes it's not worth the fight, and not don't need to fight just for everything. But I think more importantly, we go on to verse 5. Solomon is saying, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. There are things that come down that start at the top, things that start with the ruler and filter on down through the nation or through the whatever the organization that this ruler is in charge of. And he goes on and he explains what that is. He says in verses 6 and 7, that error which proceeds from the ruler, folly is set in great dignity, and the rich set in low places. I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. Another, this error that comes from the king is that everything is just turned upside down. As a result of mismanagement, as a result of corruption, as a result of failing to set priorities, everything is just upside down. What do we see? We see folly is exalted and put in, made a great dignity of that. The rich are set in low places. They maybe aren't paying their fair share or something, but they're put down. Instead of being recognized for their contribution they're making, they're no good. But the foolish and the folly is given a place of prominence and a place of dignity. Servants are sitting upon the horses and the princes are walking along beside. It's just the backwards of what it ought to be. The servants are normally the ones that tend the horses, the ones that walk alongside, the ones that lead the horses, where the prince or the coming king sets in a position of honor. If you remember when some of David's sons were trying to, near his death, were planning to take the kingdom. How did he let the nation know that Solomon was the one that he had chosen? Solomon was the one to be the next king. He took him out and he had him set on the king's horse and paraded, you might say, through the community, through the capital, so that all the people know, because this was the prince on the king's horse, he was to be the next king. But everything was upside down when the folly and the error precedes from the ruler. You know, we can look at our own situation, we can look at our own nation, look at the things that are just upside down. We need to be so careful in our reputation and things that false rumors and false speculation don't get started. But when everything gets upside down and we see, I'm going to turn to Isaiah chapter 5. I'm sorry, I kind of lost my place in my notes here for a minute, but Isaiah chapter 5, verse 20 says, woe to them that are wise in their own eyes, and verse 20, woe to them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to them that call evil good and that call good evil. Just as everything is upside down, everything seems backwards sometimes, the prince is walking beside the horse and the servant is riding the horse in the place of prominence. Isaiah is talking to the nation of Israel and saying, woe to them that call evil good and that call good evil. Now, how does that not describe our nation today? think about if you stand for biblical, traditional, godly marriage between a man and a woman, you're the bigot. Not a gay couple that goes to somebody that they know doesn't want to participate in that lifestyle so that they can force them to refuse service to them so they can put them out of business. They're the good. The Christian man that's put out of business, he's the bigot. Woe to them that call good evil and call evil good. And what are we doing today? If you oppose killing a baby after it's born, you're the one that wants to deny someone their rights. If you're the one that wants a baby to have rights because they are created in the image of God, somehow you're the evil one. You're the one that wants to deny what's the rights of a woman to make that choice. You know, woe to them that call good evil and call evil good. And that proceeds down from the top. That, as it says in verse 5, the evil that the evil under the sun, it's an error which proceeds down from the ruler, where everything is turned upside down and everything is backwards because of the lifestyle and because of the actions and of the ruler. Now, we go on to verses 8 through 11, and I think when I first started this, I first studied this, I said, okay, verse 8 begins another series of Proverbs, another separate series that's not really tied to the others. And I got my notes, page of notes in my notebook, and I studied it some more, and I realized that these tie directly back to the error that proceedeth from the ruler. So, fortunately, my pages in my notebook aren't numbered because I ripped one out and started on the next one and started over. I'm sure Pastor Forsberg has never done something like that, but anyway, we look at those things, and I saw, no, these are directly tied to the error that proceeds from the ruler. In verse 8, we read, "He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him." And I think, as we talked about this in verse 5, this is the error that proceedeth from the ruler. I think this is more, can make a broader application to this than just the idea of a king or a high government official. I think this could be anybody in a position of authority. Whether it be the ruler, which it can be, a cabinet official or a department head in the government, but it also could apply to a corporate CEO that has problems within the corporation. It could be applied to the president of a university, the president of a Bible college or seminary. Basically anyone that has a position of authority. It could be a church, almost any organization. And I think that these things and the principles that are laid out here in verses 8 through 11 can apply to anyone in that position of authority. So let's look at these now and see what they're saying. In verse 8, "He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him." I think what verse 8 is speaking about is that the mess that a ruler or someone in authority makes for themselves. They dig their own pit and fall into it. They release the serpent, and it ends up biting them. And so it's anyone in that position of authority. Anyone in that position, he brings harm to the subjects under him through abuse, through oppressive policies, the things that are not done properly, and it ends up harming the one that does that. I think that this, it's like the king, that he does wicked policies or abuse of his nation, and the nation rises up against him. And it ends up, he falls into the pit of his own making. Or the person that, next illustration of, you cut down the hedge. These were the hedgerows that surrounded property and surrounded the lands, and someone is cutting those down, and in the process, what's living in there? A snake. And a snake comes out and bites the person that's cutting down the hedge. He has a problem based upon his own doing. He dug a pit and fell into it himself. He released a snake, but the snake ended up biting him. I think, probably the closest and clearest example we might see in the world today, just look at Venezuela, a nation with tremendous oil reserves, but as a result of the socialist policies combined with corruption and mismanagement, Maduro has fallen into the pit of his own making. He's been bitten by the snake that he himself released, and only the bribes and the corruption that he's paid to his military that's kept them on board even allows him to stay in the nation or to stay alive or stay in power in any form. But it's a pit of his own making. And whether the same thing can be done of in a corporation or a CEO that implements policies, it ends up coming back to hurt them themselves. And I think that's what it's speaking of here as the error that proceeds from the ruler. An error proceeds from the top. Verse 9, it's a similar analogy. It says, "Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith. He that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt, he do not whet the edge, then must he put more strength to it. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith." Saying that it's talking of tearing down a wall and removing those stones, and in the process of moving those stones, what happens? The wall becomes unstable. The wall falls down. The wall collapses upon him. He's hurt by his own actions. He's fallen into the pit that he made himself. And he's injured and hurt by the things that he has done. And as he tries to remove that wall. And the end of that 9, end of verse 9, if he's splitting wood, he can be injured by that splitting wood, and especially in verse 10, if the axe isn't kept sharp, if the axe isn't whetted, it says the edge, he's going to injure him, and if it doesn't injure him, at least it's going to make it a lot harder, a lot more work to take place in order to split that wood. I know when I was in college, I was in animal science, so we had meats lab was part of that, and I know the instructor there, the graduate assistant, just constantly said, reminded, keep your knives sharp. Make sure they're really sharp. You're going to be cut and hurt a lot worse with a dull knife than a sharp one, because it takes more force to bring it through, so that's likely to slip. That's where you're going to be injured. And it's the same way here. If the axe is dull, it takes a lot more work. There's a lot more risk involved of not having the right tool, not having it properly used, and as a result of that, there can be great danger to that. Now, in terms of removing that wall, one of the commentaries compared this to tearing down an established policy, something that's been working, taking it away, not removing it properly, and as a result, it causes great chaos and great problems that he brings upon himself. And has no plan to fix the situation, no plan to replace the policy that he removed, not really any explanation of why it needs to be removed or why it isn't needed or how to get along without it. I know it's maybe getting a little political for some, but I think that was the big mistake Republicans made in repeal and replace. They didn't do what they needed to repeal, but they had no plan to replace either. They just tear things down, no explanation to how to make things better. Certainly our healthcare system needs some improvement, but they didn't have anything to go with it. It was just campaign slogans, and when the time came, they had nothing to offer. It was a wall that kind of came down, a wall that kind of collapsed around them, and they had nothing to offer and nothing to replace with. But that's just my opinion. You can take that for what it's worth. That's free this morning. But anyway, he goes on then, and in talking about the removing of or the splitting of wood. You know, sometimes in the bureaucracy, there's a lot of dead wood that needs to be removed. And I think that's what comes from the proceeds from the ruler is they don't do these things properly. They don't take care of the things that need to be taken care of. Sometimes things have to be removed. Some dead wood has to be cut out to make things more efficient, to make things more productive, to get to the place that you want to be. And you need to have the right tools. You need to have the axe sharp. Sometimes it's better to use a scalpel than a meat cleaver, let's put it that way, as far as some of the policies that need to be changed. And so these are things that stem from the ruler. And if we're in a position of that authority, we need to be careful how we change things and how we bring about a better situation. And I think that's what he's speaking of here, and this all ties back to the error from the king. It says in verse 10, but wisdom is profitable to direct. Now, these things take some wisdom. They take skill. They take the right tools. They take the right application of those tools. It takes some real wisdom to get the job done. It takes some wisdom to drain the swamp. Let's just put it that way. And sometimes things can get out of hand. And sometimes things happen that aren't expected. But it takes some real wisdom. Verse 11, surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. And I think we'll wrap it up with this one. But you know, that bureaucratic snake pit can come back to bite. It takes some enchantment. But when you think of enchantment, the picture I get is of the snake charmer. And this Indian swami with the turban on his head and playing his flute, and then the cobra comes up out of the little box out of the hole, and the cobra swings back and forth because the snake charmer is playing his flute, and as that goes away, the cobra goes down. But if that's not done properly, that cobra is still a deadly, venomous snake that can bite and that can kill. And so if without enchantment, without some skills as far as draining the swamp, or as far as cutting the hedge, as releasing the snake, that snake can come back to bite and can be, and it goes on then, the end of verse 11, the babbler is no better. No, the babbler, the gossip or the slanderer, he can do great harm just as much as that snake can do. I think of the babbler, somehow the term cable news comes to mind. That just the babbler that goes on, that's in colluding with the bureaucratic snake pit. And what comes back to haunt, comes back to bite. It has to be dealt with. It's not easy. It takes some real skill, some real wisdom in doing this. And if I've gotten too political, why, you can fire me, that's all right. I know some may disagree, but we have to be so careful as we see what takes place in our own nation. See, you know, when we lose God's blessing on our nation, it's all over. There's no plan B. And, you know, Israel is God's people. Israel is always going to be brought back to the Lord, and he's going to deal with them in a way that brings them back. There's no guarantee for the United States. We're not, you know, there are European nations. There's been places where the gospel went far before it went to us that turned away from God, and they're just gone as far as God's people and God's plan and his real working and blessing on their nation. Israel will be always brought back, but if we lose our country, we lose it. And there's no guarantee that there's going to be another cycle in which God will bring back the United States. But anyway, that's some of this is more opinion than gospel teaching, but we need to be so careful with our nation and remember there's an error which proceeds from the ruler. And we have to be careful and be watching over that and be praying for our leadership, praying for people that have opportunity and are in a position to do something about the evil that's taken over in our country, where we're calling good evil and evil good and dealing with things the way we are. Anyway, I believe we'll wrap it up with that. We'll continue on in the rest of this chapter. Then next week we have about 2 lessons left, I think, in the book of Ecclesiastes, and then we'll wrap this study up. Let's close in prayer then. We'll go to the next.